Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And back with us now is Linda Sarsour, who, among many other things, was one of the four national co-chairs of the Women's March on Washington. At the end of last month, she announced that she'll be leaving her post as executive director of the Arab American Association of New York to work in different ways. Among her past campaigns have been to end stop and frisk and police surveillance of Muslims in New York without cause. She also led a successful campaign to have Muslim holy days observed in New York City public schools. The New York Times has called her the Brooklyn homegirl in a hijab. She grew up Palestinian American in Sunset Park. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to WNYC. Oh, do we have Linda there? Linda, can you hear me? She's somewhere. I see her line lit up on my board. Somewhere in the ether is Linda Sarsour. And somehow we're going to get her line back, and then we will talk to Linda Sarsour. Also, let me take this opportunity to invite you to listen tonight when I host the Tuesday night edition of our national call-in show, Indivisible. That's the one we're doing for the first 100 days of the Trump administration, with different hosts on different nights of the week. I do Tuesday nights. Tonight we're going to take a look at nationalism in human history and what the Trump, Bannon, Miller administration means when they talk about nationalism in 2017. That'll be tonight at 8 here on WNYC. Now I think we have Linda Sarsour's line back up. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
And first of all, yesterday you tweeted that Trump's new executive order on immigration is just as unconstitutional as the first one. Tell us how you're reacting to Travel Ban 2.0.
I mean, basically, it's a Muslim ban number one with a little bit of cosmetic changes, but it's as unconstitutional as the first one. It is still a Muslim ban anyway, which way you put it, and we're going to continue to fight Donald Trump and his administration in a lawsuit that we have filed where I am the lead plaintiff, called Sarsour versus Trump. So we'll see where the courts take us.
They did remove the preference for religious minorities when the refugee program starts up again in 120 days. There was going to be a preference for religious minorities, which was largely read as a preference for Christians, since this was applying primarily to Muslim-majority countries. Are you reassured that that was removed?
I'm not reassured. I mean, look, this ban came out of the campaign rhetoric where Donald Trump was quite clear saying there will be a complete shutdown of Muslims, and he's keeping his promises to his followers. So we're watching this administration really closely, and we're looking at we don't care about semantics and changing of words. These are still six Muslim majority countries. There has never been a refugee from any of these countries that has ever committed an act of domestic terror against the United States of America. There really is no justification for these particular six countries that were chosen, and we believe that if we do not fight this now, that list could potentially grow to a larger list of natives from these other Muslim-majority countries.
Actually, I think it's not factually true that no refugee from any of those six countries has ever committed a domestic act of terror. I know of one in particular that I was aware of, partly because it was where I went to grad school, Ohio State, last fall, where nobody was killed, but that guy who was identified as a Somali refugee did drive his car into people and then get out and started attacking people with a knife, and that was considered an act of domestic terror committed by a Somali refugee.
I don't think the end convictions, he was not convicted of domestic terrorism, is my understanding. I mean, obviously, there are people of all backgrounds that commit acts of violence, that commit crimes in this country. But to even bring up that one example, to then say that that's a justification of banning a whole group of people from a particular country like Somalia, let's say, I still don't think that makes sense to me at all. We have, as you know, people are more victim to white supremacists in this country who are engaging in more acts of violence than any other group or domestic terrorism than any other group. And we don't hear any conversations about how we're going to counter, you know, violent white extremism in this country. So I think we need to be careful about when we even use one example of one person in the long history of refugee resettlement in this country to say that is a justification for a ban on an entire people from an entire country or six countries.
They use as a partial justification the fact that Congress and the Obama administration did identify those, the seven countries on the original list, as needing more vetting, you know, eliminating them from the visa waiver program, as you know. And so they hung on that, the need to at least vet more carefully people who come from those particular troubled countries right now where there aren't strong governments in place, or there's a lot of war and a lot of chaos where it's hard to vet people who want to come to the country, and then, you know, reevaluate in 90 days what kind of more individualized vetting process they can put into place. They argue that it's reasonable on that score.
I mean, they don't understand what the vetting process already looks like. I mean, a lot of these refugees have spent multiple years in refugee camps. They didn't just stroll up to an American embassy and ask for a piece of paper to show up here. They have done medical exams, multiple medical exams. They have had security and background checks. They have already suffered immensely in war zones. And on top of that, in poverty, in refugee camps across the country. So the vetting process is already quite extreme. And we have Syrian refugees in the U.S. who have spent almost 4 years, some up to 5 years before they got here to the U.S. or even were settled in places like Europe. But the problem here is, Brian, that if the justification is that these countries in particular need to have, you know, more vetting, it would be interesting, and I don't support any list, so I'm not in any way condoning or suggesting that we should add more countries to the list. But if we do look at history of terrorism and the usage of 9/11 as a justification, why isn't Saudi Arabia on the list? I mean, this is the kind of hypocrisy and the irony in this entire situation. So for me, people have to understand that the vetting process is already quite extreme. And if you haven't been through it yourself or do not work at a resettlement agency to understand the process, which nobody in this government has, then that is why they keep engaging in this like hyperbole rhetoric about, oh, you need extreme vetting. The vetting is already very extreme. So again, you know, in Somalia right now, we've had dozens of people die in just the past few weeks or past maybe week of drought, of dehydration. You know, we have Syrian refugees who are fleeing the very same terrorism that we're claiming that we're fighting against. So this is what I'm saying is that these people need us for sanctuary and security in our fight against terrorism. They have seen way more than we will ever experience as Americans. We have always been a country that has invited refugees and has housed refugees and has given them opportunities. Why do we stop now, and why are we focusing specifically on Muslim refugees?
My guest is Linda.
Muslim majority countries.
Linda Sarsour, Executive Director of the Arab American Association of New York. She's going to be leaving that post that she's had for a number of years to do activism in other ways, and we'll get to that. I'm just curious if you have a sense of where you think this is going to go next, because we're so focused on the imposition of this that, you know, seems so outrageous to so many people, even the 90-day temporary ban on travel from those six countries and the 120-day ban on refugees. Do you have a sense at all from, you know, your activism in Washington whether at the end of the 90 days they're going to come out with an extreme vetting program and that's going to be that, or the 120 days, or are they going to just say, no, you know, there's really no way to vet people from these countries permanently, and we're going to start adding other Muslim countries to the list?
Look, I mean, you've watched this administration just in the past 6 weeks. They're quite outrageous and outlandish. So I wouldn't be surprised if they came up with either a renewal of those 120 days or maybe an addition of additional Muslim countries, or maybe a vetting process that is extremely outrageous that may include things like, you know, taking an oath or asking people religious questions. I mean, this administration is quite it's predictable and unpredictable at the same time. So we're watching this, and we're watching this closely. Another thing I'm thinking about is, you know, Donald Trump talks about we want to fight terrorism. He oftentimes talks about fighting domestic terrorism. And as you know, under the Obama administration, there was a program called the Countering Violent Extremism Program. And this new administration is talking about changing the name and the focus of it to be called Countering Jihadi radical Islamic radicalism or something to that effect, which means that it's going to be a program specifically focusing on Muslim communities. So what is the apparatus, the counterterrorism apparatus that is going to be used to target Muslim communities, as we have already seen what it looks like under a progressive administration like Obama's, unwarranted surveillance, wiretapping, suspected terror watch lists, no-fly list, overbloated no-fly list. So God only knows what it's going to look like, or what this counter-jihadi program is going to look like under a Trump administration. So we have multiple fronts where we're watching this administration and how they're going to be working with or against Muslim communities in the United States.
I understand the NYPD's hate crimes task force investigated a threat made against you online last week. Can you tell us what happened?
Interestingly enough, I was actually in Atlanta when it happened, and there were people having a discussion on a local Bay Ridge group where a gentleman basically said that he was going to come look for me, and someone provided him the actual address of where I would be. In fact, I wasn't in New York. I was in Atlanta. So he basically promised and guaranteed the people on the list that he was going to come look for me and basically assault me. So I reported that to the New York Police Department to make sure that my staff who was at that address was safe and that they were protected. And the interesting thing, I never reported it to the media. I don't know how the Daily News found out about it, but maybe there's some sort of group. You know, there's a reporters are stationed at the NYPD. But this is the kind of stuff that's happening. People have become much more emboldened. This particular gentleman, when I looked him up online, he is has some pro-Trump stuff on his social media. And these people have been emboldened by this administration. They think that they can publicly, threaten to assault people or to even do much more horrible things, and think they can get away with it. So I caution people to, when they see any type of threats against anyone online, that they report those immediately.
When President Trump gave his speech before a joint session of Congress last week, he started by mentioning anti-Semitic attacks, and he mentioned the attack in Kansas City that had taken place as well, though he didn't characterize it. Were you encouraged that he mentioned it at all, or were you more discouraged because he didn't call it by its name?
I mean, for me, whether it was the anti-Semitic attacks against the cemeteries and the bomb threats against Jewish centers, or even the Kansas City shooting, to be honest with you, it was a little too late for me. You are the president of the United States of America. It does not take rocket science, and it doesn't take much from any human being to come out and say what's happening to the Jewish cemeteries is outrageous, and we stand against that as Americans. And it took him days to come out. And I think, honestly, he was just following the teleprompter that day, which is why people were calling him presidential. So he was... I don't even know if it came from the heart. I think he read it off the teleprompter. But what he didn't also say, other than not mentioning that it was a hate crime that happened in Kansas City, where two Indian men were, shot, one died. He didn't mention any of the mosques across the country that have been victims of arson, including in places like Santa Barbara, California, in Texas, mosque got burned to the ground, in New Tampa, in Florida, we had a mosque that was also a victim of arson. This has all happened within the last just maybe 3 weeks. So he didn't mention those. And I think if you're going to be a president, you either stand up against all forms of hate and targeting of religious minorities or religious groups, or you don't engage in any preference for one group over another.
I gather that you were invited to watch that speech sitting with Brooklyn Congresswoman Yvette Clark, but you turned her down. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us why.
I mean, I am I'm grateful for the message that Congresswoman Yvette Clark wanted to make that night by bringing someone like me who is in direct opposition to this administration, someone who is one of the national co-chairs of the largest protest in U.S. history, and to be there to make a statement, and I understood her intention. But I couldn't bring myself to sit in a space with a man who engages in hateful rhetoric against my community, someone who I believe that has created an environment, a vitriolic environment that is impacting the very communities that I organize with. And I personally don't see him as a legitimate president or someone who is fit to be president, and I did not want to sit and have my presence legitimize him as the president of the United States of America. So I kindly declined to a very fabulous champion of working people of Muslim communities, which is our, very own Brooklyn Congresswoman Yvette Clark.
You were one of the four national co-chairs of the Women's March on Washington on the day after the inauguration. Is there a meaningful follow-on? What can you describe in terms of the ripple effects of that march to this day?
You know, ever since the Women's March on Washington, which was on the first day of Donald Trump's presidency, having over 3.5 million people show up within the United States of America to stand up against this administration and to really project what our values and principles are as a nation. And then to have 6 million people worldwide join us was really an experience that I think for me personally will probably be the most memorable I have in my life. And ever since then, as you have seen, there has been consistent organizing and visible organizing across this country by numerous groups, including obviously some support from the Women's March on Washington, whether it was the airport organizing around the first Muslim ban, welcome refugees, rallies across the country, organizing around the Affordable Care Act, around issues of, you know, defunding Planned Parenthood. I mean, really seeing people really come out in big numbers on a consistent level. And we're still organizing. We have done postcard campaigns, you know, against appointees of the administration. We have done these actions we call huddles, allowing people to have toolkits to have kind of localized conversations around what can you do after the Women's March in your local communities. And right now we're gearing up towards what we're calling a day without a woman, you know, which we
tomorrow.
Call a day without immigrants. Which is tomorrow, March 8th, on International Women's Day. There's multiple actions happening around the country, multiple actions happening here in New York City. And the idea here is to start introducing the American public, many of whom have not engaged in activism. And many of the women at the Women's March told us that this was their first time ever marching in their lives. We're introducing them to different tactics, and a day without a woman is a very powerful opportunity for women to refrain from paid and unpaid labor. It is an opportunity to keep your money in your wallet. Women are one of the largest consumer groups in the country. I'm telling them tomorrow we're not shopping. And if we have to shop, we're going to support women or minority-owned businesses. And then also having people wear red in solidarity. Engage in refraining from paid and unpaid labor. And we've seen the fruits of our labor. We have the entire school district in Alexandria, Virginia, is going to be shut down tomorrow. Entire school district in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is going to be shut down tomorrow. And multiple examples like these of women-owned businesses that will be shutting down, including my organization, which is the largest social service organization in my city council district. We are an all-women organization, and our center will be closed tomorrow, and people will realize that without us, this community and the communities that we work with who speak over 8 languages will not receive service without the labor of women in our community. So this is a very powerful opportunity across the country to see what women are capable of. And we already showed that with the Women's March on Washington, and I think we have a lot more to share.
What's the unpaid labor strike aspect of tomorrow?
You know, the Women's March movement is a very inclusive movement, and unpaid labor is really for women who are what we call stay-at-home moms. And for us, that is still labor, you know, picking up kids from school, taking kids to school, making lunch, laundry. A lot of the, you know, kind of what people think is, you know, oh, well, they don't have jobs. In fact, their jobs are very important. So we're asking for partners, for spouses, for boyfriends, you know, to say, you know what, I'll pick up the kids from school today. You know, I'll help around the house. I'll make the school lunches, so that women who are also stay-at-home moms are recognized and valued for the contributions that they do for their families and the communities that they come from.
My guest is Linda Sarsour, one of the 4 national organizers of the Women's March on Washington, and now about to leave her post as executive director of the Arab American Association of New York and take on some other activist challenges. In your role as Arab American leader, though, I read that you started a crowdfunding campaign last month to restore grave sites at a Jewish cemetery in Missouri that had been desecrated in an apparent hate crime. And your crowdfunding campaign raised over $100,000. You want to tell us a little more about that?
You know, Brian, as a Muslim American, I was when I heard about the desecration of the St. Louis cemetery, Jewish cemetery, I was really more outraged than I've ever been when I hear about any type of vandalism or targeting of religious institutions. I mean, the idea that people who are have left this earth can't even rest in peace in this country, and watching those the families that were kind of flying over there to see their tombstones toppled over, crushed, and I said, how can I contribute? How can I take, you know, how can I help some people heal? And all I did was, you know, me and a friend of mine, a colleague in Philadelphia, we started a crowdfunding campaign. And we said we wanted to give a symbolic donation of $20,000 to the Jewish cemetery. And in 3 hours, we already raised $20,000. And it just went, you know, it was just multiplied from there. And we ended up actually, we're close to more than 100, and I think we're about at $120,000 right now. And then we were able to share some of that money, not only with the St. Louis Cemetery, but also with the cemetery in Philadelphia. And there's another cemetery, unfortunately, in the state of Illinois that had some minor damage, and one in upstate New York. And it was an opportunity for us to say that, you know, this may not have been our faith community, but we all believe in the same God. And it was a really welcomed gesture from our Jewish friends. And it also just tells people who we are. This is who Muslims are. We are people who are very connected to spirituality and our faith. And we believe in, you know, unity and solidarity. And we need that right now under this administration. We're all we got, Brian. Like, if we don't protect one another, if we don't support one another, we can't expect this administration to support or protect us.
Under the circumstances in this country, and maybe despite some of the other circumstances in the world, do you see Jewish groups and Muslim groups and just Muslim Americans and Jewish Americans coming together more now, or is the administration driving them apart?
I think historically we've been driven apart. Some elements of the Jewish community and some elements of the Muslim community have been driven apart, obviously, by the elephant that is always in the room, which is our different views on Palestine, Israel. And as you know, I'm a BDS activist. I'm Palestinian. And it was an opportunity to say, look, when it comes to these types of situations, when there is vandalism or targeting or any act of violence against people, all people, in particular, obviously, as a person of faith, people of faith, that I didn't ask anybody what kind of politics did those folks have that were buried at that cemetery? That was not a question that came to my mind at the moment when I was organizing this crowdfunding campaign. I think, as you know, within the United States, there's been a conflation between pro-Israel and Judaism and Jews. And as you know, there's a very large number of Jews who are pro-ending occupation in Palestine, that are pro-human rights, that are pro-justice and pro-peace. And those are the people that I've been raised around, that I've been organizing with for almost the past 16 years. So I think the people that we need to be building more transformative relationships, that's already happening. Do I believe that very right-wing Zionist groups all of a sudden are going to start getting down with the Muslim community, especially those of us who are pro-justice and peace in Palestine? Probably not. But I think that we are finding ways to support each other as Jews and Muslims, especially those of us who consider ourselves in part of the kind of progressive part of the communities that we come from.
Some people were critical of you bringing up Palestinian rights in your Women's March speech, that you were hitchhiking an issue onto the domestic ones that the march was not about, and without mentioning kind of the other side of what Palestinians, Palestinian Authority, whoever, does to Jews in Israel.
What was really interesting, and thank God my speech is quite public and went viral online, is that I didn't actually bring up the conflict. What I did was I brought up my identity, and that's the problem here, that my identity just as a Palestinian, just the fact that that I dare to say publicly on a national stage like that I am unapologetically Palestinian. I didn't even bring up the state of Israel. I didn't bring up anything. All I said was, I stand here before you unapologetically Palestinian. And what I said at the end was that I was my Palestinian grandmother who lived under military occupation is wildest dreams. Those were the only two references I made to Palestine. And I'm not ashamed of being Palestinian. I will not hide my Palestinian identity to make anyone feel comfortable. And unfortunately, my identity is political, and it is always a political statement when you find me in any space. So that's the kind of criticism that I received, and I will not hide my identity at the Women's March or dilute who I am so that people can feel comfortable coming to the march. And I'll be honest with you, Brian, I've gotten so much support. And I mean, the right wing has went after me. The right wing Zionists have went after me, which was to be expected. So I wasn't surprised at that at all. But majority of Americans have supported me. Yet last night I posted this on Facebook. I got, you know, to my office, and my kids picked it up for me, and I was out really late, got home at 11 o'clock at night, and I had this huge box of letters that I received from Houston, Texas, of people sending me support and telling me I am their leader, I am their hero, people of all backgrounds. And that, and if I show you in my office, I mean, the amounts of letters I've received from across the country have been really heartening, that people are saying to me that at this moment in 2017, that we can look up to a leader in our country who wears hijab, who is Muslim, who happens to be a Palestinian, who is a woman born and raised in Brooklyn. It's a really powerful moment. The movement has changed. The face of feminism in America has changed, and I'm very proud to be a part of that new story.
So you're leaving as executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Is it to do work at the national level?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you, Brian. I love this organization. I've been here since day one. I've served as its executive director for 11 years. It is now one of the premier immigrant rights organizations in New York City, and I'm very proud of what I built here. And it's time for me to move on, time for me to take my very important – I feel like I have an important message, and I feel like there's a lot of important work to be done on the national level, and that this country needs a voice like mine, you know, a young Arab-American, Palestinian-American, Muslim, progressive, who cares, who is intersectional, who has built very strong alliances and coalitions around this country. I have a niche for bringing people together. I have a track record of winning local campaigns, and I want to bring my skills to the national level, and I've already started doing that. The Women's March obviously helped propel me even faster into that role. So I'm excited. I have opportunities to write a book, to write my first book, and be one of the first books coming out of the American Muslim community from a young Muslim woman who is an intersectional organizer and is mainstreamed in the progressive movement in this country, and being able to tell my story about how I got here. I have, you know, I want to be able to work on, you know, electoral organizing. I really have my eyes on 2018. We have an opportunity here to use the Women's March Network to really flip some districts and win part, at least win back the House. We cannot live the next 4 years with an entire Republican Congress, Republican Senate, and a Republican White House. So I'm excited about the work that's coming ahead for me.
Well, Linda, congratulations on your move. Congratulations on the book contract. Consider this a public invitation to come here and talk about the book when it's released. And I hope you keep coming on the show and keep having this dialogue with us, even as
you
move from Brooklyn to the world stage.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to still live in Brooklyn. Can never take me out of Brooklyn, though.
Great. Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Linda Sarsour, outgoing executive director of the Arab American Association of New York. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay with us.